Accession number 30095, reel 3.
One of these craft had to type very fast. This is one of the things we learnt at Hailing Island. It ties very fast there. And she got beached. She'd put her doors open, got the troops going ashore through the water, but couldn't get off. Asked her to come behind her, take her kedge anchor and take it out to sea and drop it. So we manoeuvred ourselves behind her. This is about day 3. And by the time we got behind her and got the thing on board, we were high and dry. I've got pictures of us there. Without thinking, we all left the boat whilst walking along the beach. We could have hit a landmine, you know. I took a photograph of her spare, you know, right down there. You could see the whole craft. And we were walking on the beach 3 days later, you know, fantastic, really. But there was lots of craft there that had been shot and sunk, you know. And so that was a funny, funny story, really. But that was it. So we had to wait till the tide comes before we get off. And then, we got back to Beauty River. Now, the funny thing was, I mean, we were very young, don't forget. We were in the early 20s, then down 1920. We anchored in Beauty River, and the skipper said, "Get your heads down." Next morning, I woke up. I went on deck, and then it was like a miracle. The water was calm. The sun was shining. The birds were twittering. And I thought, this is mine. So I thought, I've just got to do something about this. I got in a dinghy, rowed out in midstream, and it's there, and I just sat there for an hour. And it had great effect on me. And I came back and woke up the troops. And I found out many years later when I was doing voluntary work at in Ham at the hospital there, I spoke to him about it. I said, I never had any feelings about D-Day after that. I said, all the noise and the gunfire, he said, it's the best thing you could have done. By sitting in that water quietly for an hour on that beach, he said, you cleared your mind. Didn't worry me after that. Other people said, oh, I can still hear it, you know. So that was that. So then we were told to take our craft to Bowness in Scotland. And we were going to be fitted out for India, Malayan landings. So we went up to Bowness. And there we had the Wrens were ashore, they had a shore base, and the Marine officer said to me, would you be prepared to drill the Wrens? They need a bit of discipline. That was great fun. So teaching me how to be careful about the language, you know. And anyway, we were ready to go. And we came down from Bowness somewhere east of Scotland. We were taken off there and told that we would be going by troop ship to India, but a skeleton crew would be taking this craft to India. So I left the corporal aboard and the Marine officer, and I took the detachment on a ship from Liverpool to Bombay. And we went to Chemba Camp, which is a transit camp there. Now,
what route did that voyage?
They went through the channel, through the Mediterranean, through the straits, you know, what do they call it? The canal.
Suez
Canal, that's right. And round that way. It was that time, it was all clear by then, you know, because that side of the war was over. And as soon as we landed, got in there, I asked for compassionate leave, you see. So the admiral was in charge of the place. He said, no, you were just... I said, oh, no, not to go home. Could I go to Cunor and see my grandparents? They're retired in Cunor. Oh, that's interesting, he said. Well, yes, your ship won't be out for another 2 months yet. Your ships, because they were a slow job, you know, taking these things through. He said, one condition, he said, there are two Wrens wanting to go there. Would you have to escort them all the way then bring them back? I said, well, that's all right, I don't mind that, you know. So I went down to Cunor and it was marvellous to see my grandparents on the station when I arrived, you know. So I had a week's leave with them. That was very nice. And then I came back, and then we went, our craft arrived, and we took our craft down to Cochin. And there we congregated, and went round the Horn of India to the Madras side, and that's where we were congregating. Then we did some dummy landings, and then we did some rifle drill and gunnery to the chaps ashore. And this particular day, we took them to on the range there, keeping the hand ready, you know, because we're just waiting to see what's going to happen. And when we came back, the ferry was a little fishing smack employed by the Navy takers, and we hit a storm. So I ordered all my chaps down below, and I stayed on the bridge of the little boat with this bloke, stripped of the naked, half waist, you know, with ammunition and stuff on top of you. And we got back to the ship, and then I became delirious. And so the next morning they took me ashore to the hospital, and I had exposure, you know, from that. So then they said, right, we'll take you, we're going to go to Trincomalee. So I had to go to Trincomalee by a special boat, and to operate, they had to cut a section of the rib and put a pump in to drain it off, you know. And that was all right. And then thereafter, they went back, and the craft had gone then because the war was over. Apparently, my corporal told me afterwards that they were all at sea, ready to land in Malaya, and we were told it was going to be a slaughter. The Japanese were waiting for us, you know. And just before that, the bomb dropped in Hiroshima, and the war was over. We didn't have to. What they did, we landed, did police work on the shore. They used the aircraft for generating electricity. Some of the craft, I wasn't on then, but some of the craft, then my corporal was telling me, they went up to the rivers. I don't know the name now. Looking for a Japanese post that didn't know the war was over. We were gunboats, really. We've still got a 4.7, so to get that going up the Wadi, that's the one. They surrendered straight away, you know. And then we took them prisoners and brought them back. And this was going on while I was recovering in hospital. Anyway, that was all over. And they apparently then were transported home by a troop ship. I was then told to convalescence. So I said, oh, no, I'm not going to a convalescent camp. I want to go to Knorr, where my grandparents look after me. Oh, that's a good idea. So I went to Knorr for 3 weeks, had my convalescence with my grandparents, and then I went up to Bombay and came home. And then I was posted to Larg in Ayrshire. That's the... what's the name of this base? Yes, HMS Copra. That was a combined operations place there. And I was doing sort of administration work, you know, because I was a regular Marine. And then we got the signal from the Admiralty, which they promised us when we first joined, that as we joined as regulars in 1940, we could take a discharge if we wanted to. So doing the full 12 years, I did 6.5 years. And I thought, well, I love the Corps, but I had no teenage life. And I'd met my wife then, was going to be my wife. And she was an army girl. So her father was in India as well. And I thought, well, no, I think I'll take a discharge. So I went back to Chatham, and he had the same RSM I had before. He said, what's up with you? You're going to swap your tin hat for a bowler? So I said, yes, I think so. You are bloody foolish. He said, you're made. You're a full sergeant. You've only done 6.5 years. He said, you've got a terrific career ahead of you. I said, yes, I know, but I had no teenage life at all. I went at 17 and a half. I said, virtually straight from school. I was only an apprentice for about 6 months. So he said, well, you're a fool. I said, well, I made up my mind, I'm going to go. So I was discharged. I went to Labour Exchange. And they said, oh, got a job for you. The Army Post Office. at in where what's the name for that again? Sorry about this. Harrods, where Harrods are, what's that part called?
Knightsbridge.
They'd commandeered a building there, and so I had to take a test, and I was all right. So I went there. Well, I met a young Marine officer, a naval officer, who'd done the same as me. He'd come out, and we kept on thinking, this selection of the savings bank, you know, a bit premature. Supposing they'd colours. Much quicker to do all the selection. One, so we went and saw this old lady, because it was a woman's civil service then, sitting on a desk. I said, we have no idea. If we were to colour code these things, we'd know what. Get back to your desk. We have a department that does that. So I said, I don't think I can stand this any longer. I said, this is not for me. He said, nor me, so I'm going to immigrate to New Zealand and to the Forestry Commission. So I thought, well, what can I do anyway? I saw his advert in the local paper. Conveyancing probate clerk. In law. I didn't even know what the word meant, quite honestly. I thought, I'll have a go. Is this all right? So I went along, saw the solicitor in charge of the firm. So he said, what have you been doing? I said, I've just come out of the Royal Marines, the war. Well, you don't know anything about law then? I said, no. So he said, well, how are you applying? I said, well, you're going to teach me, aren't you? I said, I'm a disciplined man. I'll do as I'm told. If you tell me red is black and black is white, I'll believe it. Oh. So he said, oh. So he said, well, tell me a bit about your career. So I told him about the football career. So he said, oh, I'm deeply indebted to people like you. He said, I'll bring the chief clerk down. He's just come back from the RAF. So he came and he looked all up at me and said, oh, my God, I want a trained man. I'm up to my eyeballs. So I said, well, Mr. Stones, I said, you know, if you train me, I'll do as I'm told. I won't argue with you. Now, if I was half trained, I would query what you're saying, wouldn't I? So I sold myself. So he took me on and I just lapped it. Within 2 years I had a branch office as a conveyancer. I just fell for it. Lovely. And I'm still practicing law today. And I ended up with my firm for 40 years. I was with that firm. And I had a staff of 12 at Kew and ran an office at Kew. Conveyancing, probate and litigation, county court litigation. Just one of those things.
Did you ever regret the decision?
Well, yes and no. What I did was this. This is the other side of the story which may interest you or the future. I came out in 1946. I met my wife. And my first leave, and I met her during the day at a photographer's place. She was a receptionist. And he was a friend of the family, and I had my mother used to throw a party for us whenever we came home and leave, parties were thrown. My brother was also serving then. And we were boasting, talking Urdu with thought. Because she chipped in and answered it. That took the wind out of myself. I thought, what you say? So she spoke in Urdu. I said, you know Urdu? She said, oh yes, I've been in India most of my life with the army. Well, that melted it, you know. So we got married the following year. And then my father-in-law, who is now with the Surrey ACF as a quartermaster, he said, would you be interested in training cadets? So I said, well, how do you mean? He said, well, conscription was on then, you see. He said, the Territorial Army now, the cadets was part of the Territorial Army. He said, with your experience, we need men like you to train these youngsters. Because I said, well, I know what it's like, because I joined straight from green. I said, believe me, it is hard, you know. And so he said, well, so I had an interview, and they commissioned me into the Territorial Army, the second lieutenant, and with the detachment of cadets at Richmond. And I loved it straight away because I was able to, I mean, they looked up to me greatly, obviously being a Marine. And so I was training the youngsters, and most of the youngsters, when they joined, when they were called up, were made corporal straight away because they knew the background. Actually, they had to learn. I loved the work. Then I was promoted to adjutant of the training team, which runs all the courses in Surrey. And then I was commanding officer of three times of different battalions, cadet battalions. I enjoyed it really, so I had the best of both worlds. I had my military life and I had my civilian life. And then I eventually ended up as the county training officer, adventure training officer. I was a canoeist as well, of course, that helped. And I used to run all the courses for the senior cadets, NCOs, and the officers coming in and NCOs coming in. And that was 25 years I did that. And I said, well, now's the time to retire because things were changing and it wasn't quite what I liked. And after all, it was 25 years, a long time. So I retired from the army and carried on doing voluntary work and all sorts of things in the community, you know, through the Rotary Club and things like that. So that's where I kept my hand in.
How much of your time did the territorial?
Oh, tremendous, tremendous. I mean, I used to have Tuesdays, Thursdays and Sundays, and then I would run canoeing instructions on a Sunday on the river. I'd run weekend courses for training and so forth. I used to do the Army Cadet Force itself had its training depot down at Purbright area, and where they trained potential officers and NCOs. And I used to do that twice a year for a week course instructing. So I kept my hand in all the way through and enjoyed it. It was tremendous. Didn't do me any harm.
After you came back up at the end of the war, what was the post-war social atmosphere like?
Well, I don't know. I felt that everybody was looking for a future. They were still having a nasty effect of the war, obviously. It was still on rationing, remember. I know that my mother used to feed us for ages. She had to be very careful about feeding us, etc. But I think there was a feeling that we've now got to recover. Best way I can sum it up, that there was a great admiration for us, obviously, of servicemen. They were still very respected by that generation. Not so much today, I know, but they were then. And, of course, the cadets' use units were very active then, you know, the Air Training Corps, the cadets, the sea cadets, etc. And I think all of us, people like us, were passing on our knowledge to the youngsters. And I think it was this getting back to normal was a long thing, but people seemed to be very happy, you know, the war was over and they're starting looking to what they're going to do in the future. That's all I can sum it up. Didn't seem to be any sort of bitterness or anything like that, you know. My father had, before he took on the cadets, he was at several prisoners of war camp battalions, and he got on very well with them. He said they'd make things for him and all sorts of funny things. And he didn't like the Germans very much, but he said they were all right, really. The old soldier was fine. It's the higher up of the problem. But he said the Italians were sort of doing anything you like. They were just glad to be here, you know. A lot of them were at Chertsey. It was a great establishment. I had a unit at Chertsey as well, and there's a big camp there for them, you know. A lot of them settled down in the country. You know, you see a lot of Italian names there.
What have been your own attitude towards the Germans and Italians?
Well, the Italians, I found, were not soldiers. They never were soldiers. Their attitude to life is so different. The few Germans I met, I found them all right. The soldier. It was the Nazis that was the problem. I think their attitude was completely, well, we didn't see much of those, obviously, because they were all in there. But no, I didn't see any trouble at all. But you had a job to do, and therefore you had to shoot to kill, you know, or be killed. that's what's happening abroad now, isn't it, really?
Was there any sort of lingering resentment after the war, though?
Any?
Did you feel any continuation of your...
No, I don't think so. I think once the Nazis are gone, I think there's a bit of feeling at first when they sort of blocked off the war, famous war, you know. We thought that was a bit foolish, really. But I think really we got on with their own life, quite honestly. I wasn't then in the regular forces then, so I didn't come across them anymore, you know. But I spoke to a lot of colleagues who went to Germany, and they said, you know, we actually, off the record, got on very well with them. You know, it was the powers that be that were at war, really, with the war, you know. But they were just doing as they were told, same as we did, really.
Was there any different attitude towards the Japanese?
Ah, the Japanese, yes. I think we did. I think we... I always felt that they were cruel. They were cruel. Where it's part of their training, I don't know, but they've changed country. I mean, I've got great friends of Japanese now through Rotary. We used to foster them coming over here to do their English courses, you know. And one girl now, I still talk, I met her the other, she came over last year with her family and everything, you know, and great friends. But they never talk about the war. Never talk about the war. Whereas we still talk about the war, not them. Young, she was when she first came over here, she was what, 18, 19, I think, learning English. And I said, I sort of touched on the war. She said, I don't know anything about the war. She said, didn't want to know. They have wiped it off, you know, that's a bad thing. And they're quite friendly now, aren't they, Japanese? We get on very well with them now. But I think we did hate them, the way they behaved, knowing how we've seen the state of our troops that got caught. I mean, they were a terrible mess, weren't they? You know, in the prisons there. And we were told that at that landing in Malaya, if it had come off, we were told that it was going to be a real fight. They were going to slaughter all the prisoners, we were told, before the landing. But that regime's gone, fortunately.
What has been your response to VE Day and later BJ Day? What has been your reaction to the declaration of victory,
VE
Day and BJ Day?
How do you mean,
Was it just something that happened as a matter of course, or was there?
Well, VJ Day, of course, we were abroad then when it happened. VE Day, of course, was different because we were part of that. VGA Day has never had much effect on me at all, but VE Day, I think we still feel about that one, you know, because that was a nasty war as well. Obviously, it lost a lot of lives, didn't we? Don't like the French very much, with all due respect, even though I'm of French origin. My mother was French. Again, individually, they're fine, but I think the government are not very happy about it. I know it's going to change now, but the previous chap was a bit of a diehard, wasn't he? You know, no, 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 all the time. But, I mean, when you look at it now, the French are doing better than we are, from what I can make out. You know, their welfare is far better than us nowadays. But I've never got on well with the French, funny enough. But I got on very well with the Japanese when I met them. And I've met Germans and I've got on very well with them through Rotary. We've had them over cast over here, you know, and they're quite frankly quite good.
You mentioned a little bit of interaction with the Americans.
Well, now, is this all right, is it? I have no faith at all with them, quite honestly. Toby, isn't it, Toby? When we did the landings in Sicily, they made a great fuss of us. You're going to look after us and all this sort of thing, you know. But when we saw their behaviour, we didn't think much of their action, really. I don't know what it is. What I've come across them is that they a bit of all mouth, quite honestly. Even their Marines, although we're supposed to be very friendly with them, I don't like them very much. They've made a few mistakes. And the friendly fire worries me, because that is true. I mean, look, I experienced you about dropping out chaps that way. When they come under harassment, they're inclined to give in or do something wrong, you know. Whether it's the leaders, I don't know, but I think there's a lot of swank, isn't there, with Americans. They are, that's their attitude, aren't they? That's why I think they're so unpopular abroad now. And I don't particularly like the Americans. I don't know what it is. Canadians, yes. My sister lives in Canada now. She's been for years out there with family. Canadians I find quite all right, but Americans, I don't know. I don't like them very much, sorry to say. I mean, I've come across a lot of them, even in Rotary you've come across them, but they're a bit more mouse and trousers, as I always say. Sorry about that, but they are.
You mentioned after D-Day sitting in the boat in the river, was there any more mental or physical effect on you after the war?
No, nothing at all. Nothing at all. The first effect I had, Toby, was this. When I first saw the preview of the film, what they call it?
Saving
Private Ryan. Because I was interviewed for that. Because I still belong to the Royal Marine Association as well. I was interviewed for that at the studio. And we were invited to the preview. And we went to the cinema, special cinemas now where they do previews. I think it's near Golden Square, isn't it, somewhere, I think. And lovely, comfortable chairs, couches, you know. And that first 6 minutes brought it all back. I was like that. You know, remember it? The actual invasion. And this is when I thought, my God, I've forgotten all about that. Everything was hell. And in one way, I'm rather glad, because I had forgotten by going on that river. And when I saw the psychiatrist, I told him. He said, "Yeah, now you can listen. You can do it both now." He said, "Beforehand, you had wiped it completely clear." Strange, isn't it? But the film itself is nonsense. I mean, a typical American film. But that part was very, very good. I thought the story behind it was a bit stupid, you know, looking for Private Ryan, Saving Private Ryan. But the battle condition was very well done, I think, especially the first part. Not so much the other parts, but that was all sort of studio stuff. But that one was very good. They must have put a lot of time into that. And they did have a rough time, and I'll give them a credit for that, you know. Whether again they went in, you know, as they do, waiting without thinking what they were going on and prepare themselves, I don't know, because they had a rough time, didn't they? But that's how it came, so I can remember both now without a worry.
Do you have any opinion as to how people exposed to that sort of situation should be helped to recover?
They should. I don't think there's enough of it, because at the hospital in Ham, which was a mental health place, I was a chairman of the committee there, of the voluntary committee, and I used to speak to these surgeons and psychiatrists about this. And apparently that hospital was first started at the First World War to deal with soldiers who were mentally upset. And he said, it was a great mistake, he said, that shell shock, as they called it, sometimes cowardness was shell shock. It was quite serious, had a tremendous effect on them.